God has a hard on.
Perfect world is a dream. Primitive.
Fucking asshole! He's a tight ass! He's a sadist!
You're all going to die down here.
The greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he didn't exist.
Happy heresies, my beloved true seekers. Welcome to the first ever radio show that deals with Gnosticism, the Gnostics, and Gnosis in all their degrees, flavors, and parallels. We continue our awakening at coffee, cigarettes, and Gnosis on this approximately August 25th, 2007, broadcast from the virtual Alexandria, the dimension where East meets West. I am, and I am Abraxas, the God above God as the ancients knew him, and you are beginning to understand, and understand that I am you, or at least the sleeping Prometheus deep inside of you.
I don't want any baloney, magic tricks, or psychological mumbo-jumbo.
This quote from Oscar Wilde really encompasses the ethos of the Gnostics and our existential curse. We are all in the gutter, but some of us are looking at stars. But the Gnostics decided that there had to be a better way to look at the stars, perhaps even become those stars, as Plato had claimed. Like Buddha, our Gnostic saint in the East, the Gnostics decided it was time to get out of the gutter, or at least give it our best college try, by finally tackling the essence of suffering that is earmarked into the fabric of existence.
As long as the Matrix exists, the human race will never be free.
But the Gnostics didn't look to living in the present to do this, or hoping for the virgin future, but actually move their metaphysical gaze to the past.
Careful, Chief. You dig up the past, all you get is dirty.
What went wrong that we are here in this rotting world of suffering dressed in lusty harmony, was their question. What exactly went wrong? When was that moment in which innocence and paradise were lost, when dreams collapsed into dry thoughts, when childhood succumbed to ambition? Or better encapsulated, the Gospel of Thomas says, the disciples said to Jesus, "Tell us, how will our end come?" Jesus said, "Have you found the beginning then, that you're looking for the end? You see, the end will be where the beginning is. Congratulations to the one who stands at the beginning. The one will know the end and will not taste death."
This is awe-inspiring stuff.
And thus the Gnostics began their journey back in time and memory, one of their clarion calls being, "Know thyself," a message written in the Oracle at Adelphi centuries before Jesus or anyone else alluded to it. You see, if you know who you are and what you are not, then the divine will know who you are, and you will know you are the divine.
If I'm not me, who the hell am I?
Time and space will cease to exist, and the cosmic mistake will heal itself completely, instead of hanging above you and inside of you like a pus-filled scar. Hell, we've all done it. We backtracked in our memories to understand what went amiss, but unfortunately we don't go far enough. Eventually, in our sad attempts at introspection, we fall into lakes of denial, or worse, begin blaming someone else as soon as our emotional legs get tired. We're afraid of those barbed truths, and even more afraid of those lies we must kill in order to allow our souls to breathe again. That is the human condition and the condition of our cosmos.
There are too many ideas and things and people, too many directions to go. I was starting to believe the reason it matters to care passionately about something is that it whittles the world down to a more manageable size.
But getting down to the astral nitty-gritty, the point of honest no return, is what they call gnosis, the salvific knowledge of the heart. As the Gnostic master Theodotus explains, gnosis is what we were, what we have become, where we were, where have we been cast. Where are we going? From what we liberate ourselves? What is birth? What is rebirth? I've quoted this several times before, but it's essential you understand it if not memorize it. That's the attitude the Gnostics took, and they speculated, philosophized, and then underwent a myriad of rituals to get to the beginning, or more like the beginning of the end.
When the long night comes, return to the end of the beginning.
The Gnostics were really descendants of the Hellenistic schools of Plato, Aristotle, and Pythagoras, dressed often in Jewish and Christian clothing. In the beginning, God didn't create the world. No, in the beginning happened long before, and so did our ending. Shall you take the journey with me, my beloved truth seekers?
May God stand between you and harm, in all the empty places where you must walk.
Just don't expect a long journey, but a long fight. We are at war, a spiritual war, with, as St. Paul wrote, wickedness in high places. The Gnostic revival only means that the Demiurge and his Archons will bully us even harder in order to keep the world blind, ignorant, and in a bad dream.
And if there is a hell, and those sons of bitches are from it, then there has got to be a heaven, Jacob. There's got to be.
We can play nice, with virtue, and within the arena of ideas. But let's make sure we splash plenty of bathwater in the eyes of the ruling angels while we hold the baby that is us safe. We hit orthodoxy hard with our perfect thoughts, but also elevate what is righteous within it. We confuse an already confused system by taking the high road and spitting down on the low road.
You always gotta follow the truth, even if it brings a whole damn thing crashing down around you.
We do not conduct ourselves in missionary work, but pursue gnosis like a woodland nymph and pray that it lights our souls like a California forest fire and attracts those seeking the ultimate liberating truth. There is no strength in numbers, have no such misconception. We are and will always be outnumbered, but a few, that's all we need, can change history with the simple swords of divine reason, solar compassion, and the unbridled Dionysian principle that sleeps within each one of us.
I am not an animal! I am a human being!
Like Nietzsche said, untroubled, scornful, outrageous, that is how Sophia wants us to be. She is a woman who never loves anyone but a warrior. Dovetailing and complimenting the old philosopher is the Book of Kabir, which says, in the field of this body a great war goes forward, against passion, anger, pride, and greed. It is in the kingdom of truth, contentment, and purity that this battle is raging, and the sword that rings forth most lightly is the sword of his name. When a brave knight takes the field, a host of cowards is put to flight. It is a hard fight and a wary one, this fight of the true seeker warrior, for the vow of the true seeker warrior is more hard than that of the fighter, or of the widowed wife who would follow her husband. For the fighter fights for a few hours, and the widow's struggle with death is soon ended. But the true seeker warrior's battle goes on day and night. As long as life lasts, it never ceases. This is the revolution in the name of Hypatia of Alexandria. This is a battle we have already won but must endure nonetheless. These are the last days of the Abrahamic face and their solar gods with their big penises. Like shuddering behemoths in the throes of death, they lash out one more time before the new age. This is apocalypse nowhere.
Noah!
No!
You will not control me! Noah!
No!
You will not take my soul! Noah!
No!
You will not win this game!
But before I make the fellows at my second home, the Palm Tree Garden, nervous with my calls for arms and incendiary rhetoric, let me at least continue with Sophia and her love of warriors in a very different context. And this is a modern growing flavor of Gnosticism, sometimes called Lashian or Gaian Gnosticism. To better understand this, we have the de facto founder, John Lamb Lash, author of Not in His Image, Gnostic Vision, Sacred Ecology, and the Future of Belief. Not only does this book donate us with the radical, even for Gnostics, vision of his Sophian ideology, it also is a well-researched book on the crimes of orthodoxy throughout history, a clear treatise on the rise and fall of the great mystery schools, and a handbook on several psycho-spiritual avenues. A very good read indeed. John tackles and at the same time refines many issues that Gnostic scholars have been afraid to touch with his high reason and daring conviction.
I move for no man.
I don't agree with John on several issues as much as I do agree with him on several issues, but that is fine. If you see two Gnostics in a room agreeing on everything, then there is no doubt that one or both are false Gnostics. Gnostics love to contemplate, noodle philosophy and religion, and definitely debate. This certainly got them in hot wood in the past because it took away from their effort to organize. Unlike the Roman Church, who came together smoothly like a theological Starbucks.
Bring out today!
Unlike Lashian Gnosticism, I don't believe Gaia is Sophia, which we will further discuss in the interview. To me, Sophia is the transcendental mother of the universe, beyond our scope of thought but not our mythic imagination. She is the doorway to the Pleroma or fullness of the divine, the real Holy Spirit, the compassionate yet astute principle in all human beings. She is the epitome of the trickster god, curious, disobedient, and always aiding her children. A symbol of all of us fallen spirits who landed in the Kenoma, the empty, cold universe. But that is just what yours truly believe through his trickles of gnosis. John brings another perspective to cogitate upon, and there are insights into his viewpoint. Accept or reject it, but sometimes it's just better to allow it to sift through your consciousness until some unknown blessing bubbles in the wellspring of your mind's eye.
It is a journey of evolution, adaptation, the journey we all take, a journey that unites each and every one of us.
Too often people reject anything new and seemingly outlandish, and the Gnostics and other esotericists fall into that category. Like William Blake said, what is now proved was once only imagined. When one loses his or her curiosity, one takes a foot off the pedal on the road to enlightenment. When one won't accept any more ideas or information, then one has made baby Gnostic Jesus cry. Okay, maybe that doesn't happen, but you get my gist.
I haven't got a brain!
Be open-minded, but please, don't leave your reason at the door. Like Voltaire said, those who can make you believe absurdities can make you commit atrocities. Make sure that information is aligned with your body and soul. Process, inspected, and re-inspected. Trust but verify, as one American president said. And this also goes with supernal revelation. And in the end, make up your own mind and have fun making your own mistakes. Sophia loves the warrior, after all. We are curious, we are open-minded, but boy will we battle the powers and principalities that keep us in the black iron prison, like the true seeker warrior in the battlefield. And suddenly I have the urge to go watch Excalibur. Utha, Atha, Utha, Atha, Utha, Atha, and so forth. But first the stimulating interview with John Lamb Lash. This is the Coffee, Cigarettes, and Gnosis interview. Today we have John Lamb Lash, author of Not in His Image, Gnostic Vision, Sacred Ecology, and The Future of Belief. How are you doing today, John?
Pretty well, thank you. Good to be here.
How's the summer in Spain?
Well, it's hot, but it's not murderous where I am, because the wind from Africa and the Mediterranean keeps it quite lovely.
And the Spanish do like to take their siestas and close everything up.
From 2 to 6.
Yes, nothing is open.
If not 7.
Yes, I know that very well. Anyway, thank you very much for joining us today, I guess tonight, for your time. What I like about your book is, like me, you have a strong connection to Hypatia of Alexandria. I consider her one of my patron saints. Can you give us a brief account of her life? How is she a Gnostic in your view, and how it symbolizes the true beginning of the Dark Ages?
Hypatia is a figure that I think deserves to be much more known. My book, as you know, starts out in this first chapter with the murder of Hypatia. And we have from classical sources 7 exact descriptions of this, eyewitness descriptions, which all more or less coincide. So it's quite a vivid event. Most scholars have pointed out, long before me, many scholars, that the murder of Hypatia was the single event that probably triggered the beginning of the Dark Ages. So the question is, who was this woman, and you know, how can she consider to be a Gnostic? The way that I view it, Miguel, is that Hypatia was typical, a fine example, of an urban, what we today call an urban shaman. She was a teacher at the school in Alexandria, where the famous library was located. Her father, Theon, was the head of the chair of mathematics, and she herself was gifted in mathematics and geometry. And some people say that the invention of the astrolabe should be attributed to her. So she was an accomplished woman, what we would call a university-level teacher in several disciplines. She qualifies as a Gnostic because she was also known for her skill in theology and in the arts of theurgy, that is to say, workings connected with the divine element of the world, co-creation with the divine, you might say. And so she was both an intellectual, a teacher, and a Gnostic. And as a woman, she represented, of course, the egalitarian spirit of the Gnostic schools, in that men and women had an equal status. And in every possible respect, it seems to me, from what we know of her life, she was a sterling example of the cream of the pagan intelligentsia, you might say. And so her death and the circumstances around her death mark a time when the free spiritual and intellectual life of the pagan world was shattered by religious oppression in the name of the new religion of Christianity. So this is an important woman, and her death was an event of far-reaching consequences.
And she was more than an intellectual. Was she initiated in the mystery schools?
Certainly she was. The fact that she is credited with being an expert at theology and theurgy indicates that. What that would have meant in the time and setting was that she lived was not that she merely debated dry points about arguments about the existence or non-existence of God. Not at all. She was involved in the perception and participation of divine matters. And so that is one way of defining a Gnostic. A Gnostikos is someone who knows the ways of the gods and is able to collaborate and participate in the divine element in the world. And she qualified highly in that respect.
And what were the circumstances of her death?
Well, that is differently reported, although all the sources describe the horror of the event in pretty much the same way. There are speculations about why, but it seems as if she had offended Cyril of Alexandria, who was at that time a leading ideologue for the new religion of Christianity. And also, it's important to bear in mind that the whole structure of the pagan world in which Hypatia participated, that is the structure of the mysteries and the mystery schools, which we'll talk about a little more as we go along, and the whole atmosphere of intellectual tolerance of paganism was shattered and broken by numerous events during her life. And actually, Hypatia, who died in March of 415 in this horrible attack, was living actually at a time when paganism had been banned. But because punishment by death to worship the pagan gods, those laws had already been put in effect under Constantine. But because Alexandria was such an open source of many cults and creeds, it was not enforced in Alexandria. So she still had a certain liberty. But one fine day, the door came slamming down.
And you write how it was what you call salvationism that ended basically the mystery schools, the Gnostics, and pretty much ended the Greco-Roman classic era. What exactly is salvationism?
Well, it may sound like an intimidating word, but actually what I mean by it is something quite elementary. Salvationism is the ideology of salvation. It is the belief system that states that humanity is flawed, and that we need to be redeemed or saved by a superhuman power. The specific form of salvationism that became dominant in Hypatia's time was, of course, Christianity, which still largely dominates the world today. Judaism, however, which was part of the prologue to Christianity, is also a salvationist religion. It relies on the concept of a divine Messiah, the figure of Melchizedek. It relies on the concept of a paternal Father God, a chosen race, the plan of the Father God, the mission of the Savior, and the final judgment or retribution of the Father God. Those elements belong to what I call the Redeemer Complex. And that Redeemer Complex was formed in the Judaic religion and then inherited by Christianity. And that is what I mean by salvationism. All those who adhere to those elements and believe that we, as human beings, need a superhuman source that saves us are involved in the salvationist program.
And you would say that the pagans of antiquity were not salvationists. How would you categorize them?
Well, certainly not, because if you look at pagan religion and if you look at polytheism, which is what it was, you'll see that the various gods of paganism, such as, say, Orpheus and Dionysus, or Osiris in Egypt, or the goddesses of the Near East, such as Aphrodite and Astarte, they were conceived as divine beings, as superhuman beings, certainly, but they were not conceived of as saviors of humanity. They were rather points in the divine world that reach into our world. And so the essence of paganism was communication and contact with the divine, but not dependence upon the divine to save or alter the human condition.
Veering a little bit before we get back to salvationism,
mm-hmm.
You would say that the Gnostics were basically, besides being neo-pagan or pagan influence, were the direct descendants of the mystery school, and they in turn proceeded from the ancient shamanistic traditions.
Well, certainly. There is in Europe a deep, deep shamanistic background to Europe and the Mediterranean basin, a deep shamanistic background to all the religious movements that existed and that were evident in the early Christian era. I take a different view, as you know from just having read my book,
mm-hmm.
I take a different view of how to define the Gnostics than other scholars. And that view, in answer to your question here, Miguel, focuses on two points. One point, and I think this will be helpful to people who are trying to get an approach to my work. One point is that I connect the Gnostics with the mystery schools, and it should be pointed out that other scholars haven't made that connection. Maybe some of the people who visit your site and some of the people who have been studying Gnosticism over the last few years would find that connection to be obvious. I do, but scholars don't make that connection. But I have said that the Gnostics were teachers and seers who were involved in the mystery schools, and the mystery schools were themselves the result of a long, long tradition of indigenous shamanism all across Europe and the Mediterranean. The second point I make is that these Gnostics were also the teachers of the classical world. They were not only men and women who went into mystical states and experienced altered states and explored the divine aspect of the world, but they were also turned around and they were active in society as teachers. Now, those two ideas are not widely accepted by other Gnostic scholars. I think you would recognize that. They sound a little odd.
Indeed.
But as a matter of fact, the first people who were writing about Gnosticism at the beginning of the 20th century, such as G.R.S. Mead, did make those assertions. So I'm not entirely alone in profiling Gnostics in this way.
Oh, I certainly agree with you. I've always posited that the Gnostics came from the mystery schools, but again, it seems it's something you and I easily connect the dots with. But
well, Elaine Pagels flatly denies it.
Really?
And do you know why she does? Because she says, and here she's acting out of her training, okay? She's acting out of her training and in the limits of her discipline, because she says there is no perceived textual connection. But as a matter of fact, when you read the Nag Hammadi literature, you find the word mysterion is used, isn't it? The word mysteries and
true.
Mysterion appears in the Nag Hammadi literature. So how can she say that there is no textual connection if we find the word mysteries in the Gnostic literature? I don't know, but that's her protest.
Yeah, well, scholars have to box it up in a Christian setting or else they can't sell books and
they do.
or
they,
lose their
scholars
jobs.
Have, Scholars have come toward Gnosticism with really with blinders on. And the point that I'm making, it's very interesting how things are moving very fast in regard to our perception of Gnosticism. Have you noticed that?
Oh, yeah, very true.
The Da Vinci Code, for all of its failings and foibles, gave it a real kick in the ass and really moved Gnosticism ahead in our public perception. When I started to write the early drafts of my book, I was really going out on a limb by saying that the Gnostics were the heirs of the ancient indigenous shamanism of Europe. That was like, wow, Lash. You're making a stretch, right?
Yeah.
But now, just a few years later, people are nodding and saying, huh? Yeah, that sounds right. You know? So it's moving very fast toward a broader, and I feel, much more realistic perception of the depth of the Gnostic movement.
I think what might shock a lot of Gnostics is that you claim that they are not salvationists. Doesn't that go against the grain that the Gnostics needed mediators such as Jesus, Seth, Sophia, Hermes, Trismegistus, and so forth?
Well, it does go against the grain in many ways. I'll tell you why. It's because when you look at the Nag Hammadi codices that were discovered in December of 1945, you find 13 bound tractates, so 13 booklets, in which there are about 52 documents. Okay? Let's just concentrate on this. We won't talk about non-Nag Hammadi material right now. When you look at this content of this, in the first place, it's a terrible, incoherent mess. In the second place, it is very, very contradictory insofar that it contains some elements which are pre-Christian, non-Christian, and even anti-Christian. It contains some arguments that completely reject the idea of a Messiah or a Savior. You'll find those, for instance, in the Second Treatise of the Great Seth. But at the same time, and sometimes in the very same document, it contains arguments that support a Christian or salvationist form of Gnosticism. And so people are justifiably asking, well, where in the hell is this guy Lash coming from? And why is he coming off and saying that there is this pre-Christian and anti-Christian Gnosticism that has nothing to do with the figure of Jesus Christ as we know it? You may know that on my site, metahistory.org, and in my book, I compare the Nag Hammadi codices to a pile of Lego pieces. And you know, you have a huge stack of Lego pieces in front of you in the middle of your living room. And you can make anything you want out of those pieces. You can create different kinds of creatures, supernatural creatures, birds, a bridge, a rocket, a robot. What I do is what all scholars do, but the difference is that I tell you I'm doing this. I'm completely transparent when I say that I select the Lego pieces that I want to construct a certain profile of Gnosticism. And what I have tried to do is to construct what I would consider the Sethian Ophite view of Gnosticism. There did exist a Christian or Christianized Gnosticism, which is mainly, associated with Valentinus, and also with Marcion. You could say that Valentinus and Marcion were teachers around the time of Hypatia, who were involved in constructing a form of Gnosticism that was related to the salvationist idea. I totally reject that. Why? Because to me, that was a compromise movement. I'm not interested in the compromises and the syncretic forms of Gnosticism that were developed in Alexandria in the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th century. I'm interested in the pre-Christian core of Gnosticism. So some people may think, well, John, I mean, you're really giving the game away here when you say that you just select the pieces that suit your agenda. But no, I select those pieces on the basis of my understanding that there was a pre-Christian and pagan gnosis, and I would like to recover and reconstruct that. So that is what I attempt to do. Now, to get to the point of this whole shaggy dog story, when you do that, you find that the teaching and the instruction in that pre-Christian system, the Sethian Ophite system, is not a salvationist program. It is about Illuminism. It is about is the teaching about how to discover the divine potential in ourselves and to evolve it in relation to the Sophia, the goddess of wisdom. It's a completely different sort of program. It relies on our own incentive. It relies on our belief, pistis, our faith in our own human potential, and it rejects the Messiah concept and the notion of an incarnate Son of God who comes and saves the world.
So needless to say, you don't think the Gnostics ever considered human nature, or more like the flesh, to be error, flawed, or sinful in nature?
Well, this is one of the biggest pieces of disinformation about Gnosticism that we have. And I have pointed out time and time again that there, in the material itself, there is very little evidence of this. You know, there's a scholar, Michael Allen Williams, who wrote a book called Rethinking Gnosticism. It was published, I think, in 1999.
Yes.
Now, this is not an easy book. It's more or less for insiders and scholars. But I'll tell you what Williams does in this book is he entirely refutes this notion that the Gnostics were haters of the flesh and that they rejected the material world. He shows that the evidence that is used, the textual evidence that's used to support that, is wrong, and that the argument doesn't hang together. Now, I realize that many people come to Gnosticism with that expectation. They sort of have heard somewhere, vaguely, that the Gnostics, you know, rejected the material world and hated incarnation. I don't really find that to be so. I find that to be a negative spin that was placed on the Gnostics by the church fathers who were opposing them and, you know, repressing them. Also, bear in mind that if you accept my working idea that the Gnosticism has a pagan origin, you have to realize that pagans did not by any means hold the view that this world is evil and that we are condemned to the prison of the flesh. So I think there's support for my argument from that side as well.
But wouldn't the traditional Gnostic simply say, or somebody out there on the street who've just heard the basics of Gnosticism, wouldn't they say, well, didn't the Demiurge create us, so therefore we are flawed to begin with?
Yeah, well, this is one of the great fallacies in the interpretation of the Gnostic material. When you look at you have to look at two things here. You have to look at, say, the content of the Nag Hammadi codices, and then go look at the so-called polemics, Irenaeus, Tertullian, and the church fathers who were writing against the Gnostics, the case for the prosecution of the heretics, as it were.
Right,
you know?
Yes.
Sadly, in the case of Gnosticism, we have to go to the attorneys of the church and look into the files of the attorneys of the church to find out certain things that the Gnostics said. So when you go to these two sources of information, you come up with two things that don't fit together. You find some passages in the Nag Hammadi text that say, or seem to say, because when you look really closely at the Coptic, they don't really say this, but they seem to say that the world we inhabit, the physical earth, was inhabited by an inferior deity called the Demiurge, right? As a matter of fact, if you go through the origin of the world, the hypostasis of the archons, and the tripartite tractate, you will not find that actually said. What you will find said is that the Demiurge believes himself to be the creator of our world. He falsely imagines that he has created our world. And so, let's put that piece of evidence on the table and say, this is really weird. I mean, this is ambiguous and strange, but we can't disregard this. We have to put this on the table and say, well, we don't know what to make of that. Let's look elsewhere and see if we find evidence that either confirms or denies it, okay? When we look elsewhere, we have to go to Irenaeus and to book 4 of his compendium against heresies. And in that book, Irenaeus states explicitly that the Gnostics said that our planet, the Earth, Gaia, which is specifically called Gaia in the Coptic texts.
Really?
Yes, there is a Coptic transliteration of the Greek word Gaia, and it's K-A-I, but it's recognized as the same as the Greek word Gaia. Irenaeus says that this planet, Gaia, the Earth, was formed by the metamorphosis of the divine Sophia. Well, wait, I mean, hold on here for a second. Put this piece of information on the table. Now look at these two pieces. One piece says, if you're not careful, you might think that the Demiurge created our world, because he certainly thinks he did, and there are certain pieces and passages which seem to imply that. But if you look at this other evidence, it's crystal clear that our Earth was formed uniquely from the body of Sophia. It is the body of a divine being. One of the things that I've done, and I don't know any other scholar who's done that, Miguel, because it's really a bitch of a job to sort this stuff out. But one of the things I've done is that I've put this information out to the public in as clear a way as possible, and I've said, well, what do you think? What are we going to conclude here? You know, we have a responsibility here today to draw a conclusion from this contradictory and conflicting evidence. And so I draw my conclusion, and I make it very, very clear what my conclusion is. I don't ask anybody to follow me as an authority, but I draw my conclusion. And my conclusion is that Gnostics taught that our Earth that we inhabit, the living biosphere, is actually the body of the divine Sophia, and that the rest of the solar system is formed by the archons and the forces of the Demiurge, and that we live in two systems at the same time. We live on Earth connected with Sophia, profoundly connected with her, but at the same time we live in an ambiance that is affected by the Demiurge and his archons. And this scenario is so important. I've tried so hard to make this clear that we understand the scenario, because I believe that it's true and that it will be extremely helpful for us to see our place in the cosmos if we could take this on board and understand it.
And again, putting on the hat of the Gnostic devil's advocate, don't mm-hmm. a lot of the scriptures, again, they all vary, so sometimes it's hard to pin it down, but don't they have Sophia returning to the Pleroma or overseeing us in the ninth heaven or something like that?
No, what happened is that you find traces of two teachings in the Nag Hammadi codices. You find the traces of what I consider the Sethian Ophite teachings. And then you find the Valentinian element. Now, we talked about this a little earlier. You know, Valentinus was a Gnostic in Alexandria who attempted to make a compromise solution between, is the world created by the evil Demiurge, or is the world actually a manifestation of the divine Sophia? He tried to create a compromise between those two views by saying, well, there's really two parts to the Sophia. There's a part that's trapped in matter, and that's Sophia Akamoth, the fallen Sophia. And there's the part of the Sophia that has already returned to the Pleroma,
right,
and blah, blah, blah. Now, personally, I reject that view as a bad compromise. And I encourage people to look at the Sethian Ophite view, which says that Sophia was transformed into the body of the Earth, and that she remains in the ninth sphere until she achieves her correction, by which she is again realigned and reunited, or reconciled, if you will, with the Pleroma. Now, that is actually the language that they use, that she remains in the ninth. The ninth is a mystery language, meaning the ninth is the sphere of the Earth. The eighth is the sphere of the zodiac, and the seventh is the sphere of the planetary system, the heptad, or the sphere of the Demiurge. Mm-hmm. So this jargon is very clear, that Sophia remains in the ninth realm, the realm of the physical Earth, until her consciousness is totally reintegrated into the Pleroma. This is a beautiful, beautiful myth, because it means that the Earth has a future. The Earth itself, as a living organism, Sophia embodied, has a future that returns it to the cosmic center. And the Sethian Ophites taught that we, humanity, are somehow deeply implicated in that return process. So I've tried to construct this view because I believe it is not only the accurate non-Christian, non-salvationist view, but because it has a tremendous message for our time.
And, well, before we move on to or get back to Gaia...
Your devil's advocate gig is pretty good, by the way.
Oh, thank you. I'm not throwing too much, but...
No, I mean...
Clear this up.
As I said at the beginning of this interview, and as I say on metahistory.org, Miguel, Gnosticism is not something you can get into at all if you don't get into it in depth, you know. There's no soundbite approach to Gnosticism, so I think we're doing pretty good.
Oh, yeah.
So far.
The floor is all yours. The 800-pound gorilla, or at least what has been the 800-pound gorilla in Gnosticism for a long time, is the Gospel of Thomas. Do you see it as Gnostic at all?
No, not really. I see it as very weak. You know, the Gospel of Thomas is the favorite gospel of Elaine Pagels.
Right.
And when I spoke with Elaine on a conference on Gnosticism at the Marian Institute in November 2001, this matter came up because Elaine spoke first in the morning, Saturday morning session, and she went deeply into the Gospel of Thomas, and it was very beautiful to see her. She's very inspired. She obviously loves that material. My observation is that the Gospel of Thomas has an appeal to many people who come from a Judeo-Christian background because it's non-threatening. It's not particularly heretical. It doesn't come out like the second treatise of the great Seth and just slam the resurrection in the face and say the resurrection is a lie. It's the doctrine of a dead man. If you don't know how to resurrect yourself before you die, when you die, you can do nothing. That's radical Gnosticism. And when you read the Gospel of Thomas, you've really got kind of a soft peddling of a quasi-Christian Gnosticism. There's hardly a line in it which would threaten a conventional Christian person. And not only that, but it's very appealing because it sort of presents the figure of the teacher, Rabbi Jesus, as a kind of a wise Zen monk who's, putting out these koans or paradoxes. I am against turning Gnosticism into a new and improved version of Christianity. And so I really am against the 800-pound gorilla. I've bounced him off the wall a few times, but he's bounced me off the wall a few times as well.
Yeah, because it's been around. I guess the Gospel of Judas kind of took the air out of it for a while. But
the Gospel of Judas has attracted a lot of attention, but it must be said that the Gospel of Thomas is, well, you know, if you were to say, well, what is the easiest and most accessible text of those 52 mutilated and incoherent documents from Nag Hammadi, it would certainly be it. So it's understandable that people have latched onto it. But I am teaching, as you know, I am pointing, probably would be a better word, to an alternative view of heresy. If you want to get involved in what I've been writing about, you're not only getting involved in heresy, but you're getting involved in a rare form of heresy.
Very true. Which is even more fun. The more heresy, the more fun you'll have.
Well, heresy is about having choices, isn't it?
Very true.
It's exactly what the word means. It comes from the Greek verb to choose. A heretic is somebody who chooses what they want to believe rather than accepts what's shoved down their throat. So I say long live heresy.
And you talked about how the earth is Sophia and then the archons are, or it's separated by the heavens. But isn't the one exception the sun? The sun is a redeemed archon, isn't he?
That's right. The sun is a redeemed archon. I see you've been reading my book.
Yes,
you picked up on that. You know, these are not easy things to understand here. You know, I don't know what fascinates people about Gnosticism or what draws them to it. You know, you might be able to give me some insight on that. But I will say this as both a warning and an encouragement to your listeners. If you are drawn toward these obscure teachings and you want to get into this and sink your teeth into this and take away something you can live by, you're going to have to become mythological and mythopoetic. You're going to have to open up that faculty of your mind that is able to think poetically and mythically. And you know, there is an episode, I recount the episode, the myth of the fallen Sophia in 9 episodes in my book, which you've just read.
Right.
And I think you would agree with me that I am the first scholar who has actually made that complete reconstruction. You know, scholars refer to the myth and they cite various passages, but what I attempted to do, and boy, this was not easy, let me tell you, was to actually reconstruct the story. And we end up with these 9 episodes. And in one of these episodes, this event happens that you just referred to, the conversion of the sun, the conversion of Saboath. So what happened was that the sun belongs to the realm of inorganic matter, principally. It belongs to the inorganic part of the solar system, but it is connected profoundly with the living part of the solar system, which is the Earth, through this cosmical event that happened. And I have tried to show that there is a certain scientific parallels that support this mythology. But it's far out, no matter how you cut it.
What about the Pleroma? After all, don't we Gnostics want to return to the Pleroma? Isn't our ultimate goal?
Well, some people would say that. I personally don't want to return to Pleroma unless I've got, you know, a loving community of people to go back with me. I don't want to go back by myself because it might be very roomy back there, you know. I was faulted and chastised on one of the Gnostic sites on the internet for saying that the Pleroma is the center of our galaxy.
Right, right.
Yeah.
I thought it meant like a cluster of stars or gas.
Right. Mm-hmm. Pleroma is a Greek word that means fullness or plenitude. Plenitude would probably be the exact translation of the word Pleroma. Sounds like plenitude, okay? The person who castigated me said, oh, Lash, you know, him and his astronomical this, that, and the other. We all know that the Pleroma is a spiritual dimension outside time and space. So how can Lash claim that the Pleroma is the core, the actual physical core of our galaxy? Well, I do claim that because even though the Pleroma may be understood in one sense as outside time and space, it is also in time and space. It's not either or, it's both. And I fully believe that the reconstruction I've done of the Sophia myth refers to the galactic center. It refers to an event that happened in the center of our galaxy with the result that there was a surge of a force of plasmic outpouring from the center of our galaxy into the outer limbs of the galaxy, and that produced the anomalous conditions in which our solar system is developing. So I have tried to, you know, to translate, as you know, the Gnostic mythology into astronomy and to show a correlation between those two. Now, to get back to your question about returning to the Pleroma, okay, I would like to go to the Galactic Center as much as anybody else, you know. I'd much rather go there than go to Disneyland. But at the same time, I'm following a sacred story. And this sacred story says to me that the Earth I inhabit is the body of a spiritual being, a divine being called Sophia, and she's trying to find her way back there as well. And so the story of the fallen Sophia creates an empathy and a compassion in me. And so I feel, as a reborn Gnostic, a 21st century Gnostic, well, yeah, I'd like to get back to the Pleroma, but I'd like to do it in Gaia's way. I'd like to do it with the planet. I'd like to do it in an understanding of the great cosmic story that we're all involved in. I just don't want to escape from the Earth. In fact, I'm really sad that I, you know, would have to leave the Earth. I don't want to leave this planet for an instant. This is the most beautiful place that I've ever seen. And I've been around. I've seen some other places. You know who Philip K. Dick is?
Oh, another one of my patron saints.
Yeah, I'll bet he is, and I bet your listeners know him as well.
Okay,
Philip K. Dick made a marvelous statement because he said, if you think this planet is bad, you should see a few of the others, you know. I totally agree with him. I've seen a few, you know. This is the most beautiful place I know. I want, as a Gnostic and a seer and a mystic, I want my human fate to be melded with the fate of the planet. I want to return to the to this to the Pleroma, but I don't want to do it as an escapism or as some kind of rejection of this world. I want to do it in the way of Gaia herself. And that's why I am such a champion of this story, Miguel. That's why I'm telling this story and trying to make it available to people. You know, it's not my story. I didn't invent it. I think that sometimes people hesitate because they think, uh-oh, wait a minute. Do we want to buy this guy? Do we want to buy, you know, the John Lash myth? It's not my myth. I have reconstructed this story to the best of my ability, and it's about the adventure of this divine being. It's about our involvement in her adventure, and that's how I think about returning to Pleroma.
So what I'm getting is that we basically, you probably believe in reincarnation until the cosmic will and the earth eventually, you know, its time runs out and returns to
I would think so. Mm-hmm. I would really think so. I mean, you know, I guess it's a matter of taste. I guess there are some people who are so disgusted and disappointed by the human condition or have had difficult lives or whatever who think, geez, I just want to get off the wheel, you know. I don't want to come back or whatever. I come back as much as I can, you know. I want to come back and just really be involved. I think that, you know, for many, many years, this goes back for me a long time, in my early 20s, because I became acquainted with Buddhism. As everyone knows who dips into Buddhism, there's sort of a message in Buddhism which says, well, the ultimate thing is nirvana, which means to get off the wheel. So the enlightened person or the person who achieves nirvana doesn't reincarnate anymore. So I became, in my early 20s, even before I was 20, I think, I became sort of injected with this notion, oh, yeah, well, get enlightened, get out of the wheel of rebirth and karma, I don't have to come back. Then, a few years later, in my mid-20s, I think it was, I began to delve more into Western esotericism. And in Western esotericism, like Rosicrucianism, Hermetics, and so forth, and Anthroposophy, if you will, toward the end, presented a different scenario. I said, well, the masters of the tradition of Western esotericism intentionally reincarnate over and over again. And I thought to myself, well, that's an interesting option. What do I really want to do in my heart of hearts? You know, do I want to get out of this game, never come back to the earth, or do I want to make reincarnation into my consecrated way? And I think it's important to explain both those options to people. It was certainly a revelation to me to look at both these options, and people can make up their own minds what they want to do.
And no story is complete without villains, even Sophia's story. So what about the Archons? Who are they?
Oh, the Archons are the great villains of the story. Tricksters would probably be a better word. They seem to be tricksters that are in the story in order to screw with our minds. I would describe them as mind parasites. And the understanding of who the Archons are and what they're doing in our minds and in our world is, of course, a big, big part of Gnostic teaching, as you know. You probably already also know that it's the Archons is like a hands-off subject for most scholars. How many books has Elaine Pagels written on Gnosticism? 10?
Mm-hmm.
Look in the index of any of them. You will not find Archons listed. Why is it a hands-off subject? Well, in the first place, it's really spooky. It involves the idea of mind parasites. Maybe they're extraterrestrials. We have to start delving into the supernatural now. We've got to understand something about parapsychology. And, of course, trained scholars in Christian history and theology are not prepared to make that leap.
What exactly is meta-history?
Well, meta-history is a name I kind of invented for the website that I do, metahistory.org. The essence of meta-history is very simple. It just states that we as human beings need a story to live by. Very often the story that we have is not a story that we ourselves have invented, but it's a story that's been given to us or fed to us by the church, by the government, by education, by our parents. Metahistory is really a heretic's dream, because metahistory implies that we're all able to choose and work out our own story. to go, meta means beyond. So meta history encourages you to go beyond the story that you've been given and to find a story that really suits you. So there are two aspects of what I'm doing on metahistory.org. One is that I propose the critique of belief systems. So I criticize beliefs and I look at the stories and the beliefs encoded in those stories and I analyze them with the intention of giving people the option to say, well, maybe I don't want to believe in this story, you know. Maybe I don't want to believe that Adam and Eve were thrown out of Eden because they ate the forbidden fruit. Maybe I don't want to believe that there's going to be a Messiah who will come and at the end of the days and judge the world and cast the evil people down into hell. Maybe I don't want to believe any of that. Maybe I want to believe another story. So I deal with that a lot. And the second thing I do, of course, on metahistory is I develop the recovered version of Gnosticism that I'm proposing. I wanted to say that in my presentation of the Sophia story, both on the website and in my book, it might help people who are trying to approach this material to understand that I am presenting a reworking of the material, trying to hide that from anyone, completely transparent about that. It is my reworking of the material, but the material does not originate with me. So if people have reservations about, well, do we want to buy this version of Gnosticism? This is John Lash's version. It's my reworking, but it doesn't originate with me. And I've tried to rework it in a way that is faithful to the original material. And so I'm not trying to put something over on anyone. I consider myself to be an intermediary and a vehicle to formulate this myth for modern times.
Lastly, what exactly, for the listeners that might know, what is the Gaia theory?
Well, the Gaia theory is a theory that was developed in the early 70s by James Lovelock and Lynn Margulis. And it's basically just a fancy name for the conception of the Earth as a living, intelligent being. I'll give you the description of how I describe Gaia theory in the glossary of my book. Technically, is the theory that the biotic and abiotic components of the Earth function as a single self-regulating system in which the growth and activities of organisms respond to their environment rather than passively inhabit it, thus regulating gas composition, acid-alkaline balance, the salinity of the oceans, temperature, and the amount of oxygen in the atmosphere. In short, Gaia theory means that life makes life on Earth suitable. Loosely, it's the understanding that the Earth is a living, sentient superorganism that regulates itself in accord with the life forms that inhabit it. This is the latest and hottest idea in science. And what I've tried to show is that this idea is prefigured in many aspects of the Sophia myth.
Well, I think that should do it. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, John, for joining Coffee and Cigarettes and Gnosis. It was a very stimulating interview, and we hope to have you on soon.
Well, that's fine. If there's any way to follow this up, I would be happy to do that, and it's always a pleasure to talk to other heretics.
Oh,
keep the faith.
All right,
keep the faith, if I might say, paradoxically.
All right. Well, we'll definitely have you on in the future and continue our little chat.
Thank you so much.
And there you have it, my beloved True Seekers. John Lamb Lash, author of Not in His Image, Gnostic Vision, Sacred Ecology, and the Future of Belief, giving us his Gnostic revelation. For more information on John and to read some of his articles, please visit metahistory.org. For many of you expect Sophia to be an enigma for a while. After all, she, like the right brain of mankind, has been pushed to the side for almost 2,000 years, perhaps even further when Aristotle and many in the academy decided Plato was just getting too mystical. To resurrect her, understand her, and develop her in both our minds and hearts will take some effort and time, but she is waiting for us with her astral arms open. She is waiting for her warriors. This has been Coffee, Cigarettes, and Gnosis. I am, and I am Abraxas, broadcasting from the virtual Alexandria. The road has ended, the song is over, thought I'd have something more to say. But don't cultivate any troubles, my beloved true seekers, because like heaven above you, the spy that loved you, I'm keeping all of your secrets safe with me tonight. Hello and goodbye as always,